Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. Today we are discussing what doctors need to know about gastric and esophageal cancer. It's estimated that more than 2,500 Australians were diagnosed with gastric cancer last year, while about 1,700 Australians were diagnosed with esophageal cancer. This podcast is sponsored by the PanCare Foundation and is funded by the Australian Government. The PanCare Foundation provides support to people impacted by a diagnosis of upper gastrointestinal cancer. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the PanCare Foundation. To learn more, I'm joined by Dr. Ashraf Toki, a general and upper gastrointestinal surgeon from Melbourne. He's actually joining me from Nottingham in the UK, where he's gaining experience at the third busiest esophageal and gastric cancer centre in Europe after he was awarded the Buongiorno Younger Fellows Travel Grant. Dr. Toki, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Toki, let's start by unpacking the prevalence of gastric and esophageal cancers in Australia. How widespread are these diseases and who is affected?
Esophageal and gastric cancers, whilst they are two separate disease processes, we do combine them together as an upper GI cancer. And they are becoming overall more common in Australia and in the Western world. In 2022, there were approximately 1,700 diagnoses of esophageal cancer, and slightly more diagnoses of gastric cancer, around about 25 to 2,600 cases. And whilst they are not the most common cancers that are diagnosed, we hear of breast and colon cancers being much more common, they're still prevalent enough to be concerned about. So for gastric cancers, about 1% of the population will be diagnosed with gastric cancer during their lifetime. And for esophageal cancer, about kind of 0.5 to 0.6, but higher in males. So they are something that we should be aware of.
And Dr. Toki, let's zoom in on the primary care setting. What are some of the common diagnostic issues that are faced by general practitioners when trying to identify these diseases?
Yeah, that's one of the hardest parts about gastric and esophageal cancer is they are insidious cancers and their symptoms can be quite vague. And so recognising the symptoms and recognising when to worry are really important, especially for GPs who are the first line of call for the people who present. The stomach is a bigger issue. The stomach is quite a capacious organ. It's got a large body and then really just the proximal aspect, the gastroesophageal junction and the pylorus are the areas where if there are lesions, there may be more obvious symptoms. But if you have a lesion on the side of the stomach, you may present with fatigue, a bit of pain can be here or there. A lot of the times presentation may be the other non-specific symptoms that can be related to other disease processes, loss of weight or anemia if that's picked up. But unfortunately, unless a cancer in the stomach is large enough to obstruct the distal aspect of the stomach or the proximal aspect of the stomach, the symptoms aren't very specific. Similarly with esophageal cancer, because the prevalence isn't common, the symptoms that people present with are often ignored. So symptoms of reflux or a bit of difficulty swallowing can be ignored for a month or two or three, or seen in many other benign disease processes, so aren't recognised as worrying until they're a bit more advanced. On top of that, we don't have screening tools currently in Australia that we use routinely for gastric and esophageal cancers. So we are waiting at the moment for patients to become symptomatic before we start investigating for these diseases.
And Dr. Toki, you mentioned symptoms there. With symptoms so hard to spot, what are some first-line investigations that general practitioners could do?
The first and most important thing for a GP to do when seeing these patients is really take a thorough history and recognise what those worrying symptoms are. So we talk about red flag symptoms, and then even without red flag symptoms, there are worrying symptoms that patients have. I talk about red flag symptoms in the setting of dysphagia, which is probably the most common worrying symptom for patients with an esophageal lesion, essentially problems with swallowing, and often they'll present with bread or meat. Solid foods that they find harder to swallow than liquids. So you'll find that these people say that they've changed their diet. And similarly, pain that is persisting in the upper abdomen for more than 2 or 3 weeks, or loss of weight, or reflux that's refractory to antacid medication are these red flags that you need to be worried about, especially in older populations above the age of 50. But really, the first step for most GPs before investigations that they're doing themselves is a really good and thorough history. So understanding their family history, is there any family history of cancer, their background. We know that certain populations, such as East Asia and South America, have an increased risk of esophageal and gastric cancer due to diet and other exposures. Any previous investigations in the past, and any past medical history, but primarily the symptoms that they're actually presenting for, that you often need to ask the patients. It is useful to do some other investigations. So I think reasonable to check hemoglobin levels and iron studies if you have patients who lose weight or are fatigued, looking for an iron deficiency anemia. Obviously, there are other causes of loss of weight. So we expect that in our population between the age of 45 and 75 now, we should be doing routine stool blood tests, FOBTs. But really, those red flag patients, they should really be recommended for an endoscopy. That's really the first step of investigation if you are worried about them.
And Dr. Toki, when should a GP refer to a specialist?
It's tricky because when a patient is referred to a specialist, especially in the public system, can be quite a different period of time from when they actually get to see their specialist. And that's because, again, the lack of prevalence of the disease process and the workload on our public healthcare system is quite significant. Anyone with high-risk symptoms, so that dysphagia, progressive abdominal pain, upper abdominal pain for longer than 2 weeks, iron deficiency anemia, or refractory reflux. And refractory reflux for me is reflux that is ongoing despite adequate antacid medication with a PPI, proton pump inhibitor, more than 6 weeks. These patients should be referred to a specialist, and that's because they need early investigation. A dysphagia is a stock standard diagnostic concern when I think about esophageal cancer. And so seeing an upper GI surgeon or someone with an expertise in esophagogastric cancer, or seeing a gastroenterologist who can actively intervene and perform an endoscopy at an early date, is really important.
And Dr. Toki, looking at a bigger picture now, what trends have we seen with these diseases in the past 20 years or so in terms of the number of people affected, in terms of prognosis, and whether it's being caught early?
We have made some fantastic progress in the last 20 years, and that's something that's exciting. And the two main areas that we've improved for prognosis and outcomes is one, earlier recognition of symptoms and access to endoscopy. Some places do it better than the others. In the UK, the two-week waiting pathway and resources such as the cytosponge, which is a sponge that you swallow and pull out of your esophagus, which takes the lining of the esophagus, has been quite effective here. But we've also introduced good quality multimodal treatment. So introduction of chemotherapy and radiotherapy on top of surgery itself has made a huge difference in outcomes. We're now operating on the right patients. We're staging them appropriately with CT scans and PET scans. And as a result, survival's changed quite dramatically. So in the early 90s, survival from esophageal cancer, unfortunately, was only around 12%. It's still quite poor. It's still only about 23 to 24%, but that's because we pick up the disease late. However, if you get to surgery, if we pick up the disease in a timely fashion to be a curative candidate, survival is 50% or more at 5 years, and we're continuing to make improvements in that area. So in the last 5 years, we've had an introduction of immunotherapy, so nivolumab for advanced gastric and esophageal cancer, or even as an adjuvant setting for esophageal cancer. Hopefully that'll make a bit of a difference. And then there are some other current trials looking into immunotherapy and other roles. So that's been really promising. The other thing that I think we do well, we've done better nowadays, is multidisciplinary care. So esophageal and gastric cancer is emotionally and physically a demanding disease on the patient and their family. And treating the cancer is one thing, but we also need to consider treating the patient on the whole. We're better now at recognizing the importance of specialized dietitian inputs for our patients. the roles of clinical nurse specialists. There's great evidence to say that units that have clinical nurse specialists provide a better quality care for their patients, and that has been recognised and introduced into healthcare services across Australia. And we have routine multidisciplinary meetings to discuss the patient manager and make sure there's uniformity in their decisions. So we are doing better with introducing care that provides aspects of the whole patient's journey, but we can still do better. We know that this is a life-changing surgery. We know we need better peer support service, and we need more uniformity across Australia to ensure that the right services are available. We have made amazing progress in the last 20 years, though, and that's really exciting.
And Ash, you're joining me from the UK. You're at the third busiest esophageal and gastric cancer centre in Europe, and you're on a travel grant thanks to the Royal Australian College of Surgeons. What differences have you noticed between practicing in Australia and in the UK?
Yeah, so I'm based in Nottingham at the moment. I'm doing an upper GI fellowship here, helped funded by the Royal Australian College of Surgeons in Bongiorno, which I'm very thankful for. The main reason I came here was exposure to volume in a centralised service. The UK, with the size of the population, has a much higher volume of cancer care. So the centre that I'm at right now, we perform approximately 150 esophagogastric resections a year. And what that means is that with that volume, there is a much more standardised pathway of treatment as well as diagnosis. It's always challenging in Australia. One of the great things they've introduced here is a two-week wait pathway for any patients who have high-risk symptoms, and that means that if you have any symptoms and your GP is worried about you, you get a gastroscopy or an endoscopy within 2 weeks. That's harder for us to introduce in Australia because the prevalence is so low, but we know that better access to endoscopy means earlier diagnosis for patients with cancer, and that will make a difference in Australia. I have to say that despite all of that, I think that the care that we provide in Australia is as good as anywhere else in the world for these types of cancers.
That is reassuring. Dr. Toki, thank you so much for joining me today.
That's okay. Thanks very much for having me.
My special guest has been Dr. Ashraf Toki, a general and upper gastrointestinal surgeon from Melbourne, and he's been joining me from Nottingham in the UK, where he's on a travel grant after being awarded the Bongiorno Younger Fellows Travel Grant. This podcast is sponsored by the PanCare Foundation and funded by the Australian Government. The PanCare Foundation provides support to people impacted by a diagnosis of upper gastrointestinal cancer. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the PanCare Foundation. You can find more podcasts on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.